What did we turn that into? Religion. Those who don't want to know go on about how it was only a tropical storm or volcanic eruption, and ignore that the tropical storm or volcanic eruption gave precise instructions. There was a flow of information. God has spoken. The faithful, in turn, see the true and only God behind it. As if the being of God, the sublime figure of creation, would care about a small ethnic group on a ridiculous world called Earth among trillions of planets. Even more insane, as if he would go racing about on this insignificant planet with a vehicle that descends on a mountain in smoke and fire and makes it glow. Whereby the same God still issued the instruction before his landing to erect a fence around the mountain to avoid the people being harmed. All previous attempts at an explanation, no matter how clever and profound the intention, are on a hiding to nothing. The facts should determine our insight, not religious or psychological wishful thinking. What facts? Those of the temples across the world, in honor of the gods. Teotihuacan in Mexico, the place at which the gods conferred, the place also at which the gods are buried. During the period of the night when the sun did not yet shine, where there was not yet day, the gods assembled at the place called Teotihuacan. And this Teotihuacan is not some one-horse town where a few temples are located. All the buildings on the main street, the Avenida de los Muertes, form a model of our solar system, including Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, about which the Stone Age planners could not know anything other than through the gods, the teachers. Uruk, one of the five cities in Mesopotamia founded by the gods, was modeled on a heavenly city on another star. In China, Hangzhou, Marco Polo's Lingan or Qingzhe, was called the heavenly city. They believed their city was an image of the cities of the gods in the heavens, writes the ethnologist Carl F. Kallenberg. And in Beijing, in the middle of the capital of the Chinese Empire, there stands the palace of heavenly emperors. Just like that? So that atheistic China remembers a heavenly emperor? How divorced from the world does theology and comparative religion have to be to avoid bringing the facts in the ancient texts, the sculptures, the rituals, and the heavenly cities under one umbrella? An umbrella, by the way, which covers a multitude of things and provides a meaningful explanation for everything. Rome, the holy city. Why is it located where it is? The god of war, Mars, once made a king's daughter pregnant. What else? She gave birth to twins, Romulus and Remus. The children were set adrift on the river Tiber in a willow basket. Remember Moses in the basket on the Nile, and were ultimately nursed by a female wolf. Decades later, Romulus had long become king, and the god Jupiter kidnapped Romulus and took him to heaven. From that time on, his divine name was Quirinus, and the location of these incomprehensible events was called Rome. Among the Germanic peoples, the supreme god was called Odin, also Wotan, the angry one. Of course, his parents, Bor and Bestla, came from heaven. In the land of the gods, in Asgard, he sat on a throne, and could oversee both the world of the gods and the world of humans. His war horse had 8 legs and was the fastest means of transport in the firmament. On his shoulder sat the holy ravens Hugin and Munin, who on their wings could see everything that was happening on earth. What was that in Egypt? Nothing on earth escaped the falcon Horus, a son of Osiris and Isis. The eye of Horus is keeping watch. Thor, Donar the Thunderer, was a son of Odin, and, as so often, a mixture between heaven and earth. Thor's mother was accordingly the human Jörth. Thor's tool was a gigantic hammer that hung on a magic belt. The innumerable enemies that Thor slaughtered also included the architect Trum. Why did Thor kill Trum? Because the latter was meant to build the fortress of the gods, Asgard. But something went wrong. In the end, many descendants of the gods landed in Valhalla. And this, in turn, is not located in some arbitrary spot on Earth. Take a map of Germany and draw a line through the present-day cities of Aachen, Frankfurt, Würzburg, Nuremberg, and Donaustauf. All these points have their origin in the Stone Age and can be connected with a dead straight line. After about 300 kilometers as the crow flies, the stretch ends at a hill behind Donaustauf. That is where the temple complex of Valhalla is located. Nowadays, tourists drive up to the impressive columned hall by car. The temple in honor of great Germans was built by King Ludwig I of Bavaria, 1786 to 1868. But according to legend, the original Valhalla, the funerary temple of the god Odin, was in the region. Communities, cultures, and peoples are all connected by myth. In the view of the East African Maasai, who were located mostly in the south of Kenya, there once lived upon the earth a young man by the name of Kintu, and he fell in love with the daughter of a heavenly being that had visited earth. The father permitted Kintu to go to heaven for a time to learn. But when the pair remained in love also in the heavenly realms, the father sent both of them back to earth to instruct humans in all matters. This is very similar to the myth of the Bantu peoples in today's South Africa. There, the heavenly god Nzame had descended to earth to investigate the planet. Here he fell in love with an extremely beautiful human woman, Mboja. The pair begat a son and called him Bingo. The supreme god was angry about this cross between a celestial and terrestrial being, and the two of them were not allowed to return to heaven. The pair instructed humans in all matters, and now we know the origin of the popular expression, Bingo. Bingo. The Shilluk tribes in southern Sudan say that the first human being, Omara, had originally come from heaven. At that time, humans still lived like wild animals and killed one another. But Omara weaned them away from the animals and taught them everything they needed to know. Omara had also founded the first kingdom on earth. All was the same. The original teachers always came from the stars. The Nuba tribe lives primarily in the middle of Sudan and forms the largest non-Arab group. They are a group of more than a million people, which nevertheless speak different languages. All of them have the creation myth in common, according to which the heavenly god Nuba ordered his divine messenger, Su, to bring grain to humans. To this end, he was to lower the grain kernels from heaven to earth on a long bamboo pole. As soon as the kernels had arrived on earth, the messenger of the gods was to beat a drum. According to other versions, he lowers it on a long hemp rope. As soon as the heavenly god heard the sound of the drum, he intended to pull the bamboo pole up again so that humans could not use it to climb up to heaven. But the divine messenger was driven by curiosity, and he opened the sack of grain before he reached earth. Now some of the kernels fell down directly onto the drum. The heavenly god heard the faint drum beats and thought his messenger had reached earth, so he quickly pulled the bamboo pole up again. The messenger fell to earth, and with him the sack full of grain, which broke open on the ground. So the divine messenger showed humans the grain and taught them how to make fields and grow cereals. Here the question arises as to the origin of certain foods. Both the Central and South American tribes hold the view that maize was brought to earth by the gods, and originally in four colors, yellow, white, red, and black. The same applies to bananas. There is no knowledge of an original banana. Rice, too, is supposed to be a gift from heaven, the brilliant Indologist Armin Rizzi reports. I wrote extensively about the Dogon tribe in the Republic of Mali in my last book. Their heavenly teacher was called Nomo and came from the constellation of Sirius. This Nomo also told the Dogon about the Sirius system. He explained to them that Sirius was a dual star, currently Sirius A plus B, and that there were still additional celestial bodies in the system, which are still unknown to our astronomers. South American peoples, including the Inca and Warao tribes, say that originally humans had lived in heaven and had descended from time to time to hunt here. It was only later that they settled here, but they had sporadically been visited again and taught by their heavenly ancestors. Reports of the same kind can be found among the Kogi Indians in Colombia. They live in the mountains on the Caribbean side of Colombia. Their original heavenly teachers created the first humans, instructed them in all matters, and continue to visit them even today. It was the same teachers who warned human beings thousands of years ago about a flood which would be intentionally caused and ordered them to build ships. And the priests, the older brothers, all descended from heaven. That is astonishing for a lateral thinker like myself, for the same story was told worlds and oceans away from Colombia. The Sumerian King List, WB444, currently in the British Museum in London, says, "After the flood had passed, the kingdom descended from heaven once more." And the same is told in the Gilgamesh epic, which also originates from Sumer. After the floods, the gods descended from the heavens. Who would have the sorry courage to ignore this worldwide accumulation of statements? In what age are we living? In the 17th century, or the age of global communications? The Tutush native peoples on the northwest coast of California not only report about a thunderbird which descended from the heavens and instructed their ancestors, but they also still represent this thunderbird on their totem poles today. The Hopi in Arizona, this is something my loyal readers are familiar with, know about the heavenly teachers, and naturally venerate these teachers in the form of dolls. The first world was Tukpela, the endless universe. But right at the beginning, so our elders tell us, there was only the creator, Taiwa. Around him was infinite space. There was neither a beginning nor an end, neither time nor form, just immeasurable emptiness. That is how it has been handed down in the Book of the Hopi, the collection of myths of this Native American tribe that today lives in Arizona. And White Bear, the oldest Hopi, described to the NASA designer Joseph Blumrich what originally happened. "This is the story of my ancestors and the clans who came to this part of the world. The continent on which my people lived for a long time sank into the sea, and the people had to leave it. In the first world, the deity Taiwa created human beings. He gave them reason. He gave them knowledge. He gave them all the things they need for their life, and he gave them the law and the duties they had to fulfill in this part of the world. And as a cross-connection for new readers, naturally the Kayapo on the upper Amazon, 8,000 kilometers distant from the Hopi, know the same thing and celebrate it in their dances even today. These, then, are not just obscure tales handed down, but verifiable evidence. Totem poles, Kachina dolls, Kayapo dances, gods who have descended, chiseled in stone worldwide, sacred places where the gods were once at work, and so on. We call all of this illustrative material. Bingo. And how do we act? We continue to live in the dulled, sticky mess of the psychology of religion, which has answers to everything, none of which are true. 2 years ago, I spoke at the theological faculty of a Swiss university in the Department of Comparative Religions, a quite ordinary lecture in a quite ordinary lecture hall with 30 quite ordinary students. I spoke about flying vehicles in the ancient Indian writings, the so-called Vimanas. When I had finished, the dean of the faculty explained to his students how these texts were to be understood. When a young man today drives through the landscape in his open-top car, his hair flutters in the wind. He has the feeling that he is flying. That is what happened thousands of years ago. At that time, the offspring of the prosperous rulers drove into the arena in richly decorated chariots, often with pearls, and drawn by four horses. Their long hair fluttered in the wind. They thought they were flying. And I thought I was dreaming. In the ancient Indian texts, there is a clear differentiation between chariots with wheels that roll on the ground and those without wheels that fly over and above the earth and even to the moon. But in the theological faculties, even those teaching comparative religion, most people live in the Middle Ages. Nothing new is added. The same applies with regard to the most sacred book of Christianity, the Bible. Theologians persist in proclaiming that the Bible contains the Word of God. The famous Jesuit and professor of theology, Karl Rahner, the mentor of whole hosts of young priests, asserts that the story of the Old Testament came from the God who ultimately revealed himself in Jesus Christ. The scripture of the Old and New Testament had the same originator. The Old Testament was, from the beginning, an open progression towards final salvation steered by God. The theology professor Jacques Guillet teaches that the stories in the Bible were, without exception, reports about the fulfillment of a word of God. This schema applies in all cases. Aha! In fact, and every theologian should know this, the Old Testament is a work full of contradictions, written by innumerable authors at various times, and often texts from outside sources were inserted. For example, the story of the flood that comes from much older Sumerian writings, or the stirring story of the little boy Moses who floated down the Nile in a little basket. The same is already reported about the Babylonian ruler Sargon I, 1,000 years before Moses. The Old Testament glorifies a pseudo-god who descends to humans in smoke, fire, noise, and heat. In this context, even the vehicle of this god is described in detail in the book of Ezekiel. And since my first work, Chariots of the Gods, a copy of that heavenly vehicle has been drawn by a NASA rocket engineer. We know today what Ezekiel was describing. A similar thing applies to biblical manna, or the Ark of the Covenant. Modern knowledge exposes the Ark of the Covenant as a life-threatening technical device, which, furthermore, is not of this earth. The explanations of our time are, without exception, sensible, logical, and scientifically comprehensible. But that is of no interest to any theologian. Professor Hermann Oberth, 1894 to 1989, the father of space travel, told me some years ago, "There are scholars who behave like stuffed geese. They no longer take in new knowledge." The book of the Old Testament prophet Job describes a Leviathan as follows. Chapter 40. His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. When he raiseth up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of breakings they purify themselves. The sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold, the spear, the dart, nor the habergeon. What is being described here? Jacques Guillet says, without exception, reports about the fulfillment of a word of God. This schema applies in all cases. There are, in our time, increasing numbers of books by authors who can read the book of books in various languages, and who correctly analyze the nonsense that has been interpreted into the Old Testament. Thus, Walter Jürg Langbein, theologian and comrade-in-arms from the beginning, picks apart Holy Scripture and uncovers the various original sources that were rated to make the Bible. His analyses appear to have provoked as little interest as the work of Mauro Biglino, who fluently reads Hebrew and knows all the links to the Aramaic and Semitic roots. In Mauro Biglino, it becomes clear that angels were nothing other than extraterrestrials, and that there is a crucial difference between angels and cherubim. While angels are persons, cherubim are machines. Every Bible reader is left with the belief that a single great God has been at work in the Old Testament. Nothing of the kind is true. The reference is always to the Elohim, the gods in plural. Accordingly, the translation regarding the creation of the human being is not, "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness," but "we want to make man in our image." A fairy tale? No, it is the concordant primal memory of human beings, and the same is reflected in the tales worldwide. Long ago there was a time in which all people lived up in heaven. So starts one of the creation myths of the Inuit. Moon spirits and heavenly beings created the first humans, and later there was also sexual contact between the moon spirits and Inuit women. The Japanese tribe of the Yamasachi tells of a time when there were still demigods on Earth who commuted between heaven and Earth as they wished. Like elsewhere, here too, it came to sexual intercourse between the offspring of a human deity and humans. The product was, what else, half gods, half humans. The Japanese Amewakahiko kings founded their ruling house directly together with heaven. The origin of our ruling house extends back into the age of the gods. With Jimmu Tenno, the sequence of terrestrial rulers begins. Now, because this land is the land of the gods, it happens from time to time that gods live as humans among us and unite with humans. Something similar can be heard in the world of Egyptian tales. All rulers of the Old Kingdom descended directly from some god or other, and those gods expressly wanted humans who were similar to them. Kings as sons of the gods. Tibet, China, Greece, and many more say hello. Flying chariots in ancient India, with Solomon in the Bible. Already heard the one about the flying carpets in the Arabian and Persian tales? The knowledge of visits by gods and the creation of humans is global. Not to recognize this is thoroughly unscientific. And the psychological variations that keep being wheeled out in explanation of this fantastical reality are no more than grumpy vanity. The Baltic Latvian people may be more closely related to us than remote King Solomon. Their principal god was called Dievs. For the Romans, gods equals Dei. In French, today, still, God equals Dieu. Dievs lived in heaven and ruled there over vast riches. He rode around the heavenly mountain on his flying horse, and at the time of the terrestrial harvest, descended from heaven to earth. Chinese mythology is familiar with nine heavens, whereby the supreme heavenly god resided in the constellation of the Great Bear. The original emperors reached the earth with fire-breathing dragons. In the Tibetan highlands, it is not just the first ruler, Gezer, who came from space, but also many other gods. And how? Heaven resounded, the earth shook, and there was the roaring of dragons. The quote could come from the Old Testament, but it doesn't. It comes from Tibetan mythology. Other heavenly beings of Tibet used a rope or ladder to descend. Many sons of God descend from the heaven of the gods to the earth of humans. Then they become the rulers and kings of human beings. Tierra del Fuego, the southern tip of South America, is poles apart from Tibet. Like everywhere else, the primal human being, Kinos, came to earth to bring order to it. Then he flew back to heaven. He now lives among the stars. It is no different among the Pawnee people in what is Nebraska today. According to their teaching, humans were created by stellar beings, and the heavenly ones who had come down to us repeatedly, with fire and smoke. Food for thought, there are 11,000 kilometers as the crow flies between Tierra del Fuego in South America and the Great Plains of the USA. We lack perspective. Every scientist, however hard-working, has to specialize. There is no alternative. Knowledge has become too extensive. The paradox here. Specialization is precisely the reason why the connections fail to be seen. It is impossible for an Egyptologist to know the Indian writings of the Mahabharata. All the texts from the field of ancient India are not even known to the specialists in Indology. There are simply too many. If even the Indologists don't have a complete overview, how then is the Egyptologist supposed to learn about the gigantic body of Indian literature alongside his own specialism? Of course, supercomputers could show the links. to the extent that the texts were previously scanned in and the right program existed. Personally, I need 6 months to battle my way even superficially through the Mahabharata, and specifically the Drona Parva, part of the Mahabharata. Scholars who make this effort just once in their lives know for all eternity that the ancient gods can only be a reference to space travelers from distant worlds. Among those knowledgeable about the ancient Indian texts, any discussion about alien space travelers thousands of years ago only provokes a weary smile. Of course they were here. Anyone who still disputes this does not know the comprehensive textual material. The Drona Parva describes spaceships in the firmament, then terrible heavenly weapons in comparison to which every tropical storm, every earthquake, every volcanic eruption is a mere hiccup. There was a clear differentiation between cities in the firmament, we would describe them as generational spaceships today, and smaller space shuttles. Whereby, and this is worth noting, the men who translated these texts from Sanskrit into English lived in the last century, except one. Therefore, they couldn't have the faintest idea about mother spaceships, aircraft, space shuttles, etc. The translation of verse 50 in the Drona Parva says specifically, "The three cities came together in the firmament." It was translated in 1888. Weapon systems are described that burn everything through concentrated heat rays. Others are activated through the eyes of the pilot. Then there are hypnotic weapons, or weapons that produce illusions in the firmament, weapons that can make mountain chains explode, and others that could tear open the whole planet if they were deployed. The Drona Parva describes aerial battles between different armed flying machines, which can change their position in the firmament at lightning speed. This is where we need a short quote from my book, Habe ich mich geirrt. Scorched by the heat of the weapons, the world staggered in heat. Elephants were burned and stumbled about. The water boiled. All the fishes died. The trees fell by the dozen. Horses and war chariots burned up. It was a nightmarish sight. The dead bodies were mutilated from the terrible heat. They no longer looked human. Never before has there been such a gruesome weapon. Never before have we heard of such a weapon. The hair of the warriors and their fingernails and toenails fell out from the effect of this weapon. All life paled because it was overlaid with the deadly breath of the god. And far from where the weapon was deployed, even the unborn children died in their mother's wombs. We Westerners have no idea. We bask in the feeling of being the greatest, indeed the pinnacle of evolution. We don't care about the ancient traditions of cultures. And the weapon systems in the thousand-year-old texts of the Drona Parva have long been adequately explained. They were tropical storms. Since when do tropical storms cause the effects described? And since when are tropical storms also responsible for deadly radiation that kills unborn children in their mother's wombs? And in any case, how did people thousands of years ago know anything at all about deadly radiation? We are resting on the completely false laurels of our self-aggrandizement. The flying chariots of thousands of years ago, nothing but meaningless chatter and foolish fantasies. So said Professor Hermann Jacobi 160 years ago. 160 years in the past. Yet the views of yesteryear, at the time probably carefully considered by highly intelligent professors with great integrity, have at no time since then been questioned. At least not by the relevant scientists. There is no new school, and the old knowledge is gumming up the brains, and books like the present one or those of my outstanding colleagues don't count. Why? I said so in the introduction. Because its hypotheses and evidence do not fit into the laboriously constructed mosaic of established conventional wisdom, scholars will put it on the list of those utopian books which it is advisable not to talk about. What to do? Provide enlightenment and let the zeitgeist do its work. The Bantu tribe in Cameroon tells of its oldest patriarch that he flew down to their tribal homeland in a large, hollowed-out tree. Everything we can see was made by Mube. First he made the earth, then the grass steps, then put the animals upon them. Nyoenduma made a great rock rain, whereupon it opened with great thunder and brought forth the first two humans. Humans created by some heavenly beings. This is also told by the small tribe of the Abasi in West Africa. Abasi brought the people living in heaven directly to earth. He created all things above, all things below. He created the water and the forest and the rivers and the springs and the animals. He created all the things that are there in the whole world. But he did not create the human beings, because they lived aloft with Abasi in his heavenly city. A heavenly city was also inhabited by the king of Salem, a priest of the supreme god of the Jews, or the Tibetan son of heaven, Gezer. He originally lived in a flying city that shone in the firmament and possessed roofs of heavenly iron which resisted every lightning bolt, or the Arab historian Nashwan ibn Sa'id, who died around 1195 and who told about a city of metal which had in the past appeared out of nothingness. The whole town stood on silver gleaming pillars, and water had been guided through the facility in metal channels. Or Hadhad, father of Bilqis, queen of Sheba. His residence was a flying palace made of metal and towers. Or, as already mentioned, the three cities in the firmament of the ancient Indian Drone Purv. Or, cities in the heavens which gleamed like crystals described in the Book of Enoch. Or, there are many such examples. Heavenly cities are simply a part of the traditions of peoples. Be it the most forgotten tribe somewhere in Africa, be it in the highlands of Tibet, or be it in the profound books of the ancient Jews. Humans had to be able to speak before they learned to write. The first language was dictated by the gods. That is what several historians of antiquity say. Human beings are only human through language, but in order to invent language, they already had to be human. The quote comes from the statesman and scholar Wilhelm von Humboldt, 1787 to 1835. A bush is a bush and not a moon. The sun is an illuminated sphere in the firmament and not a watercourse. Human beings are human beings and neither crocodile nor bird. In order to understand one another, the first humans had to mean the same thing. Only then does writing become possible. Moses was given the tablets of the law, if we believe the Old Testament, from his God on Mount Sinai. The Sumerians were given writing by the god An. It is no different in Tibet, India, or China. We recall the fact that originally all letters and pictograms and characters were deemed, without exception, to be sacred by all people and were only comprehensible to the priests. According to that view, writing also came from the stars, as Karl Kohlenberg, with his thorough knowledge of myths, confirms. Then, in about 1600 BC, this Hammurabi, 1728 to 1686, appears, who, how could it be otherwise, was born in heaven. His mother was made pregnant by the sun god. Naturally, Hammurabi became the king of Babylon, and as such he left a splendid body of law, the Code of Hammurabi. The text had been chiseled into an over 2-meter-high stone pillar, which was excavated at the start of the 20th century in Susa, what today is Shush, in Iran. In his laws, Hammurabi explicitly refers to divine revelation. We should be able to assume that the legislator will not start his imposing work with a whopping lie. But a lot is possible among politicians. In 280 paragraphs, the people now know about the law, but also about the financial system, the rules of inheritance, or of marriage. The Code of Hammurabi deals with several categories of people. There were those who were free, semi-free, and slaves. But within this class system, all people were equal. The free people had to adhere to the rules between one another, as did the semi-free people and slaves. Some examples. If a man breaks into a house, he shall be buried after he has been killed in front of the site of the break-in. If the robber is not caught, the city and the elders shall replace for the person robbed everything they have lost. If a man steals the underage son of another, he shall be killed. If someone takes a wife but does not conclude a contract with her, then this woman is not his spouse. If a man hires an ox for threshing, payment shall be one measure of grain. If a donkey is hired for threshing, payment shall be a half measure of grain. Hardly a detail that Hammurabi has forgotten. His code regulates divorce, illness, property, inheritance law, the payment of day laborers, and much more, indeed even the taking of hostages. At the end of his work, Hammurabi had the words chiseled into the pillar, "In the days to come and for all time, let the king who rules this land observe the words of justice I have written on my monument." Many legislators from other cultures did indeed use Hammurabi's code as a model in the course of human history. Today, his original stone pillar is kept in Paris in the Louvre. It seems that those gods, the heavenly ones from another solar system, have repeatedly involved themselves in human development. And today, where do we stand? Clearly, they are involving themselves again. What future will that produce?